Today on Vox Talks, why are some ethnic groups in Africa politically powerful and others aren't? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Sub-Saharan Africa has many hundreds of ethnic groups, some of which have been active in post-colonial politics and some of which have not. A new paper draws on historical sources to explain two factors that led to the politicisation of ethnicity on the continent. Valeria Rueda of the University of Nottingham, she's a CEPR fellow as well, is one of the authors and she joins me today. Welcome to Vox Talks.
Hi, Tim.
Now, is this paper, Valeria, is it about economic history or is it about politics or is it about culture?
Okay, so that's a difficult question. But I would say it's a paper about history and historical economic structures shaping culture in a way that affects politics. So if we go to the question we study, we're interested in history because we're studying historical economic shocks, in particular the diffusion of cash crop agriculture, and also a technological shock, an innovation shock, which is the diffusion of print technologies in sub-Saharan Africa. And we're interested in how these events shape culture because we're interested in their effect on how people see themselves. So that's a cultural thing going on there. We're interested in how cash crop agriculture and print technologies shape identity. So that's a cultural outcome. And this identity matters for politics because your ethnic identity will play a role in determining who you vote for or the parties you identify with. So ethnic allegiance are important for elections in Africa. They're also important for elections like we're seeing right now in the context of the American election. Obviously, ethnic allegiances are quite important there, and they're going to matter for determining, for instance, electoral outcomes or conflict or things like this.
Now, anyone who spent some time in Africa will know that if you talk to people who live there, they can describe both a national identity and an ethnic identity. I guess it's an obvious question, but why aren't those the same?
So it's a really difficult question. And it's a question of definition. I think real work on that will be the work of a political philosopher. So I'll aim here for a very simple, or someone would say simplified, answer. And so we can think about ethnicity as something that's the shared identity based on common descent and culture. And national identity is also a shared identity based on an idea of common descent, but it's different because it's going to be tied to a state. Okay, so the idea is that national identity will be shared between people who are born or raised or who were the children of migrants from a given political state. In the case of sub-Saharan Africa, they don't necessarily often coincide. And this is a result of many factors, but one of them is that colonialism made very large states with arbitrary boundaries. And these states would mix groups that had separate identities before, sometimes would also split groups that had common identities. And on top of that, the colonial presence varied greatly within these arbitrary states. So the nation building inside these states was unequally distributed. So we end up with two coexisting identities, kind of pre-existing ethnic identities and national identities with varying strengths across the territory. And that's the situation that we have. So that's why these two things are not the same.
This ethnic identity is important in African politics today.
Yes, I'll simplify and give a very brief answer, but there's a huge body of literature that looks at how ethnic diversity and ethnic identity is linked to growth and development. And so there's many reasons why ethnic identity may impact African politics. And one of them, sort of the most obvious that comes to mind, is how ethnic identities have played a role in conflict. So there are well-known examples of ethnic conflicts like the Rwandan genocide against the Tutsis or the Biafran war in Nigeria. So these are instances of ethnic identity being important for African politics because they have played a role in conflict. there's also other ways in which ethnic identity matters for African politics, and it's also the provision of public goods. So ethnic favoritism may impact, for instance, where schools are built or where roads are built or things like this. So in that sense, it also plays a role.
Now, in this paper, you've investigated the impact of what you describe as two socio-economic revolutions. And before we get into them, take me back to the beginning of this story, before these revolutions happen. What's happening in Africa at that time?
The events that we study are happening in the 19th century. So they actually start in the mid and kind of even early 19th century, which is a time where obviously there starts to be European presence in the continent. It's slightly before the scramble for Africa, but it's obviously colonial context, or it's pre-existing the colonial context. But very importantly, it's a period of globalization, right? So this is the first wave of globalization. And with this comes a big movement of extraction of mineral and agricultural resources outside of Europe. So that's the case, for instance, in sub-Saharan Africa, where cash crop agriculture, which is the production of agricultural resources for export, that's booming. And that's also linked to the period of growing globalization. And obviously, missionary expansion is also an instance of globalization. It's an instance of spiritual imperialism and a globalization of culture. So there's a big cultural transformation that's also going on at that period of time.
Okay, so let's look at cash crops first of all. What change are we describing here? What's happening?
So the intensive use of land by smallholder farmers for agricultural production of crops to export. So these crops would be oil palm, groundnuts, cocoa, coffee. So actually things that today we still think as of cash crops, especially if we think of coffee or cocoa. And most of this production was done by African farmers instead of large plantations. So that's a difference, for instance, in comparison to what happened in the Caribbean before. And these sites of cash crop production become economic hubs and attract a wide variety of people. They attract a lot of migrant labor.
And how does this reinforce ethnic identity then?
The mechanism we have at play is a mechanism that's tied to income inequality. So cash crop productions are profitable. This is a good business. And so the people who have access to land for cash crop production, they get richer, right? So the people who lived in these areas that were suitable for cash crop production have an incentive to emphasize their historical linkage to the land as their natural birthright to it. Mm-hmm. Because if it's your natural birthright to have property rights on these valuable pieces of land, then you can't prevent migrants to get the land. So that's going to shape ethnic identity because there's an incentive to reinforce that identity as something that will give you rights to economic resources. And on top of that, at that time, the colonial states were not really interested in enforcing formal land rights. So they kept this system going. There's going to be a large role for local communities to enforce these property rights. And one way to enforce these rights is going to be to claim this natural birthright to the land.
Now, the second revolution is what you've termed print technologies. And how did the printed word spread through Africa at this time?
Okay, so until the late 18th or early 19th century, African literature was mostly in oral form. So folk tales, myths, poetry were passed from generations to generations orally. And the consensus regarding the spread of the printed word in sub-Saharan Africa is very, very closely tied to the expansion of Christian missionary activity.
Yes.
Because missionaries wanted to print Bibles in indigenous languages to convert people. And so they started formalizing languages so that the Bible could be printed and diffused in these languages. And also sometimes works of linguistics were conducted by missionaries as a sort of guide for other missionaries in the field. So for instance, the Principles of Ethic Grammar was written in Nigeria in 1857 by a missionary and was printed at a mission press. So it's important that for our work to bear in mind that the spread of the printed word in Africa is very much an external shock, and that's going to create a lot of strange patterns.
And your idea of how print technology increases ethnic politicization, is it the same mechanism as for cash crops?
No. So the mechanisms at work are quite different. So in the previous case, in the case of cash crops, we're talking about a mechanism of exclusion, right? So you want to use ethnic identity to exclude people from other ethnicities from access to the land. Here, there's a mechanism that's driven by technology, the printed word. The written word facilitates and accelerates the definition of a shared ancestry. Because first, the boundaries of what constitute the group are going to be much more clearly defined if a language is standardized, which we mean that by standardization is that there's a common grammar and common spelling rules and that we know how to print it and things like how to write them and things like this. So the process of standardization of vernacular, for instance, is well described for Europe with different and fuzzily defined dialects that were then standardized into a common French or German. That's very well studied for the case of Europe. Mm. But in the case of Africa, this is a much more sharp process, obviously because it's external. So it comes from missionaries and a lot of European missionaries who are doing this linguistic work of writing grammars and creating dictionaries on languages that they don't understand that well. So sometimes the boundaries of what was a given language were created very artificially and not very correctly. So there's work on this, for instance, for the case of the Herero by Martina Strömer, a professor of African studies in Austria. And it's a sharper process because it's external, but it also arrives at a time compared to Europe where printing is more developed. This is a time of industrialization. So printing is cheaper, it's more efficient, it's faster. So it can be a much faster process compared to what happened in Europe. This, by the way, what we're defining is obviously a process that was described before for Europe by Benedict Anderson, a very, very famous political scientist. And he described this process as the formation of an imagined community. And when once a language is standardized and codified and printed, people can start writing and diffusing a history of their own group. You can start writing and diffusing foundational myths or histories of your own ethnic group. So Anderson studies the formation of these imagined national communities in Europe as a very important process for the consolidation of nationalism in Europe. But in the African case, this is a much stronger phenomenon again, because missionaries arrive at the heyday of European nationalism. So Europeans projected ideas of the fact that each group had a natural identity, and they projected these ideas into what they defined as relevant and cohesive groups, which sometimes weren't. As they printed these languages and standardized these languages, and then from there, histories of these groups were written and printed, these ethnic identities were constructed. And so these imagined communities were constructed. So an example of this would be the formation of the Yoruba identity, which is very much influenced by missionaries who very early on wrote the first grammars for this language. And also missionaries very early on wrote the history of the Yoruba, which is a foundational written and printed textbook. This is a sort of story of the formation of imagined communities through the spread of print technologies in Africa, but that is much stronger because of this happening in the context of the 19th century, in a context of industrialization, and in a context of nationalism worldwide.
I mean, this is a fascinating story, Valeria, but you're an economist. Where do you get data to test this?
So we have data from multiple sources. For cash crop data, this was the work that's mostly compiled by my co-authors, so Philip Rossler and Yannick Pengel, who are two political scientists doing outstanding work, and they have specialized on cash crop, on the history of cash crop production in sub-Saharan Africa. And their data comes from work that was compiled by a team of economic geographers in the 1950s who mapped the precise location of about 95% of African exports in the late 1950s.
Wow.
So from there, from these maps, we have a precise, very painstakingly put together, very precise maps of the location of production of these main cash crops. And for print technologies, the diffusion of printing and the diffusion of books and text in written and printed form in African languages, we rely on bibliographies of African texts. So either through compilations of library holdings or actually compilations of bibliographies that were put together mostly for the use of missionaries in the field. So these publications were useful, for instance, for missionaries who were working in schools and wanted to know what kind of textbook materials were available in the language they were teaching, what dictionaries were available, and so on and so forth. So these bibliographies allow us to see which languages are printed, when they start to be printed, and how much they're printed.
And so the big question, can we estimate, put numbers on how big a difference that cash crops and printing made?
Yeah, the main takeaway from our paper is that we find a difference. So these two things make a difference in terms of ethnic identity and ethnic salience, but in different ways. So I think that's what's fascinating from when you can just sort of see it in the data and the numbers. We observe that cash crops and print technologies are linked to politicization. So ethnic groups that were in contact with cash crop production or whose languages were standardized and written, they're more likely to be relevant in politics. But so in that sense, they both matter for politicization. If you look at other things, such as the instance of interethnic marriage, it's mostly only cash crops that seem to be associated with endogamy. Ah. So especially endogamy of very similar, even if you compare in-group with people from other very closely related groups, people whose ethnic groups are in contact with cash crops tend to be very, very strongly endogamous. Yes, so the fact that we observe cash crop agriculture being much more tied to endogamy, we think that this is linked to a process described by sociologists as social closure. So your ethnic identity is salient, it exists, but on top of that, there's an incentive to keep everybody out of the group. And obviously one way of doing that is by forbidding marriage outside the group.
We're describing participation in post-colonial politics. Do these two factors also contribute to ethnic conflicts like the ones you mentioned at the beginning?
Yes, that's a route we investigated, and we found that both cash crop and print technologies are correlated with increased ethnic conflict post-1990. So there's no difference between the two in that front. But obviously, ethnic conflict is complicated, it sort of has many different faces, so it's hard to conclude from that. So perhaps the fact that both of these historical shocks are linked to an increased relevance in politics of ethnic groups is sufficient for increasing conflict risk, but we still, I think, need more investigation to actually conclude that. Precisely. So as I said earlier on, obviously there's a huge amount of literature on ethnic conflict in Africa, and I think we didn't push sufficiently far that line to conclude on that.
Well, talking about making conclusions, I mean, this is a very complex, nuanced situation. We're talking about events that happened more than a century ago. Can you be sure that you can make a causal link here and that your results are robust?
We try. We conduct all sorts of robustness checks and try to make sure that this is not driven by alternative explanations. So one obvious one is education, especially when you think about the diffusion of print technologies, because we show that actually the diffusion of print technologies in our specific context that we're studying is not necessarily linked to more education. So it's very unlikely that all of our results are driven by education. We also control for this. We also look at different treatments. That's the word we would use. So looking at locations of missionary schools where there wasn't necessarily printing work going on, and we observed that that's not necessarily linked with more politicization. There's all sorts of other possible alternative explanations. So maybe there are geographic characteristics. There's the risk that all these shocks are happening in places that have certain geographic characteristics. Maybe they have better access to water, they're closer to the coast, and because of that, there's going to be just a specific different development pattern, and maybe that's explaining seeing our results, but we observe that our results are also true when we focus on ethnic movers. So people of a given ethnicity who don't live in, we call the ancestral homeland. So what you would think as the homeland of that group, these effects still persist. We try to predict actual cash crop production with the suitability for crops. We are also worried that the fact that certain groups, because they were larger, they were more likely to attract missionaries or to start producing cash crops. So to limit for that, we have estimations of the number of people from that ethnic group, estimates from missionaries. So everything's per capita or per perceived capita. And we also limit comparisons to within groups that had at least some kind of missionary contact. And we observe that this is still very robust.
Okay, last thing. Valeria, I noticed that you've made the point in the paper that your research design was pre-registered. Why do you make that point? Why is it important?
This is a bit atypical because our work is not an experiment. So I think pre-registration is becoming quite common in experimental work. But for history work, this is a bit atypical. And I think there was something in us that was a bit, we wanted to try the experiment of doing this. So we had some promising, very correlational or anecdotal results at first, but we had to conduct this massive data collection, data merging before actually doing the proper work and doing all these tedious robustness checks that I've just talked about. So we decided to, instead of just going ahead and collecting all the data and see what would come out, we try to read a little bit more the literature and sort of have a model of what would be expected from there, register it and register how we would test our predictions and then do the analysis. So the idea behind this is that first, I think for us, in terms of credibility by doing this, we wanted to say we did the theory first and we didn't sort of fish out the theory to explain results that we observed.
Yeah.
We wanted to avoid fishing for significant results, you know, so avoid the risk of p-hacking, which obviously is something that has been very much described. And so it worked well. And I think it also allowed us to be very honest. There are things that are pre-registered in the paper and didn't work out. So for instance, we had predictions in terms of block voting. We thought that people exposed to these shocks would vote in a much more homogeneous way, and we didn't find evidence of this. So obviously it's a bit hard because you think, oh, it's risky and I'm not going to be published because I have this null finding. But at least if somebody's interested in our work and they observe that this doesn't work, well, they know that's not an avenue of research, or that if they want to do it, then they have to do it in a smarter way.
Oh, I'm glad it came off for you, considering the amount of work you've put in. Valeria, that's fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Recommend reading the paper because you can really see where all the work has been put in, and it's called Cash Crops, Sprint Technologies and the Politicization of Ethnicity in Africa. It's a CEPR discussion paper 15162 if you want to look it up that way, and the authors are Yannick Pengel, Philip Russler and Valeria Rueda. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the most innovative economic research every week, so subscribe to Vox Talks, you never miss an episode. And remember, you can find 10 years of Vox Talks at voxeu.org/vox-talks.